Major Fossil, Real 3.
Yes, these people used to try and fool us by attempting to infiltrate wearing Canadian or American uniform, and we soon cottoned on to what their plans were. One or two of them could probably come through, then they were soon caught up and interrogated. And we had a very, very good intelligence section. Number 10 Commando boasted some troops, a troop consisting of about 60 people. We had about two troops, I think, in 10 Commando, who were Germans or German speakers who were victims of the Nazis, a Nazi regime. So they were very, very useful. In fact, there was a lot of operations that took place in Europe. We couldn't have succeeded without their personal help. And these chaps soon knew whether it was false or true. And our intelligence section were very good like that, because they had a wealth of experience. And they'd met these people before, and the attempts that they would make to try and infiltrate through these lines, North Africa, Italy, and Normandy. Unfortunately, about 3 or 4 days after D-Day, our positions remained static. There was the odd incursion, us into their lines, theirs into our lines. Our positions were held, and we were waiting for Khan to fall. The intention was that Khan should have fallen within the first 2 or 3 days, but it took 6 weeks to dislodge the Germans from the Khan area. But 3 or 4 days after D-Day, our brigade commander, Brigadier the Lord Lovett, unfortunately was very, very seriously wounded. He'd gone out and he was moving. He'd been out to see Number 4 Commando, his old commando, and he was on his way to see Number 6 Commando, who was commanded by Derek Mills Roberts, who was, in fact, Colonel Lovett's senior company commander. On the Dieppe Raid. This is the Mills Roberts who led Group 1 on the Dieppe Raid. Well, he was now commanding Number 6 Commando. And they were at Monsieur Saulnier's farmhouse in Amfreville, where they had their commando headquarters, which was only about 1/4 mile down the road from Brigade HQ. Not further front, just down the road, same road. And on his way back, he was very, very badly wounded. Some say it was a sniper from the church, but others say it was a piece of shrapnel from a mortar. So we don't really know, but we do know he was very badly wounded. And he went to the brigade regimental aid post, where our medical officer, Bruce Tulloch, not the Bruce Tulloch of athletic fame, but another one, was the unit MO, and the senior brigade medical officer was Lieutenant Colonel Black. Well, Lovett was patched up as best as they were able to do on the front line, and he was evacuated by jeep, along with other severe casualties, back to the bridgeheads, and eventually evacuated back to England. But thankfully, several weeks later, we got a signal back from him, from hospital, saying that he was progressing quite well and wished the brigade every success in their future venture. And he added his last rider to that message, not one step back. And that, again, was another very famous epitaph that he gave to the army commanders in that day, not one step back, because he said any ground which has been hard fought for should never be surrendered. It didn't take long for the then senior commando to take over the brigade, and that fell to Derek Mills Roberts, who was commanding Number 6 Commando, and he immediately assumed command of the brigade. Robert Dawson, by this time, of course, had taken over command of Number 4 Commando many months before. RWP Dawson, CBE, DSO, I think MC. And he and Number 4 Commando had tremendous success in Normandy. Peter Young and his commando, Number 3, they had tremendous success in Normandy. Six Commando. I'm not sure who took over Six Commando from Derek Mills Roberts. I'm not sure whether it was Peter Bartholomew or Roger Mende. I'm not sure. But they continue to have success. And 45 Royal Marine Commandos, who was with us as part of the brigade, they had tremendous success. By success, I mean individual actions that each commando sent virtually on a nightly basis, not necessarily the same areas, because obviously the pattern would become too obvious and the Germans knew precisely what you were doing. But one night, a commander would send a fighting patrol out. The next night, a commander would send out a small patrol to bring back prisoners for interrogation purposes. Then another night, another patrol would go out from another commander, and perhaps followed the night later by a fighting patrol. Another very useful gimmick that we pursued with in Normandy was by use of captured German weapons like the Smeisers, the Mausers, the MG-34s and 42s. The Germans could recognize their own weapons, as indeed we could recognize our own Bren guns. The Bren guns was a very slow-firing automatic weapon. Dead accurate, but very slow. But the German Smeisers and the MG-34s and 42s, the light machine guns, and the MG-42 was slightly heavier. Their rapid fire was fantastic. I mean, they used to fire somewhere in the region of 900 to 1,000 bullets a minute. Short bursts was enough to knock a few hundred people over if they were in a straight line. And by use of these captured weapons, Derek Mills Roberts, again, he devised this ploy of doing a firefight by four commando on the one side using part weapons, six commando on the other side using the other captured weapons, and they'd fire into German lines. I mean, obviously, there's no point in killing us, but they'd fire into German lines. The German night patrols were now wondering if one of their other patrols were being engaged. And, of course, they would get the odd Bren gun. And they would think, ah, there are more Germans here than, you know, the opposition. So they would come to investigate, and by so doing, fell into the trap. And we were quite successful in that. We got quite a lot of chaps taken that way. A number of them were Polish... they were sort of prisoners of war who'd been involved in the Russian campaign by the Russians. They were first in the Russian army, then taken by the Germans and conscripted as labour force into the German army. When the Germans wanted more firepower, they would then be promised all sorts of things if they took arms against the Allies. So we had a good number of dissident Poles, Latvians, Estonians, Czechs, Hungarians.
What was their attitude?
Very alakific. Couldn't give two monkeys. If they knew that they could give up, they would. But behind them were some pretty nasty people. When I say nasty people, I'm talking about the real Gestapo Nazi type of man. We had the Hermann Göring division, who were our opponents at one time. We also had the 21st SS Panzer Division, and they were fanatics. And they knew that they couldn't always rely on the Poles, Latvians, Czechs, Hungarians, the other people who'd been conscripted into the German army. They knew that they couldn't rely on them because of the experience that they had, I suppose, in North Africa and Italy. But they were kept at bay by these, as I say, 21st SS Panzer Division. They were quite the cream of the German panzers, and they were hard to... We had to pit all our wits to beat them at their own game, and the Hermann Göring Division, of course. We came across Hitler Youth at one or two occasions.
How did you know that?
By capturing one or two, and by the tenacity that these people had in their fighting. I mean, they had no aircraft as such to speak about. I mean, all the time I was in Normandy, I think I saw about eight German aircraft. And every day I used to see about 80 British or Allied. And you can always tell an Allied aircraft by the various markings that it had. The German aircraft, whether they be a fighter or a light bomber, you could only hear, you could hardly see. He'd come streaking over hedge high, and he was gone before you knew it. They did straddle our brigade HQ with a stick of bombs about a fortnight after D-Day. And we were lucky in that one bomb that landed straight in brigade HQ grounds, the orchard behind brigade HQ, failed to go off. And our SORE, Staff Officer Royal Engineers, a chap called Major Holmes, he soon dealt with it the following day. But again, as I say, it was a dud bomb, so we were lucky. Had that gone up, I think a few casualties would have resulted from it.
You were saying about the Hitler Youth.
Yes, the Hitler Youth. Well, we discovered that they were in operation when we were in Osnabrück and again on the Rhine crossing. Their opposition to our firepower, where we had a weaker force, as soon as you put a tremendous amount of firepower in, the white flag would suddenly go up and the opposition would be only too willing to give up, surrender. Again, we had to be careful because there were one or two of our fellows caught by going out to meet their surrender only to be mown down by a machine gunner. But these other people, the Hitler Youth people, they were fanatics. They just would not give up. It was very difficult to roust them out. They just had to be killed. And when I say they had to be killed, I don't mean, you know, sort of capture them and then shoot them in the head, but, you know, you just had to fight to the end. You knew they were there, you knew they were fanatics, you knew they weren't going to give themselves up. You either lobbed grenades at them, fired mortar bombs at them if they were a distance away, or just kept peppering them with rifle fire, sniper fire, anything you could get a hold on, get them out.
But this was, you came across the Hitler Youth later in Germany, did you?
Yes, yes.
Normandy.
Oh, not in Normandy, no. This was later in Germany. This was sort of crossing the River Rhine on at Wesel. We came across elements of them. Osnabrück, we came across elements of them. We also came across them at near Belsen when we were crossing the River Aller near Celle. This was in April 45. And they were still so fanatic that the end of the war to the remainder of the German population was literally weeks away. I mean, everybody knew that because the Russians had broken through and we just couldn't keep up with the German retreat. It was a job to keep up with their retreat. We thought we were moving fast by covering 50, 60, 70 miles a day, but you know, every time we sort of went to a target that we'd aimed for, only to find that Germans had left the previous night. And we thought we were moving fast, but by golly, they were moving a lot faster. But that was later, much later.
Going back to Normandy, you were saying?
We stayed static in our positions in Normandy for about 6 weeks. And because the Germans began to know our actions, our tactics, it was decided that we would change positions with the airborne, who were on our right flank. So they took over our positions and our patrolling role, and we took over their positions and their patrolling role. But we were never rested during all this period. We still continued our advances into, or when I say advances, the patrolling into the Bois de Bavant area, where the airborne were, covering Randall, Breville, and the whole of the Bois de Bavant. And this carried on till the end of August, when we were given orders to move forward. We went through the Bois de Bavant, and we holed up in a big house near the River Deves. Mills Roberts told us that we were going to split the brigade in two, and that one part, the advance brigade, would follow the railway line across the River Deves for about 8 miles, and we were to take the high ground near the town of Dozulé. We moved out and we used the same patrolling methods as was used in Normandy and on other raids, the use of tape, white tape. And they were reeled out like a fireman's reel, and this tape would be laid yard upon yard upon yard, and the people would follow this tape. Because it's at night time, you weren't allowed any lights, you couldn't read any compasses because there was no marks or areas you can pinpoint as a zone where you can follow to. Although we were following this river, this railway line, across the river, and once across the river, the tape went across the fields onto the high ground. And this is the tape that we continue to follow. We went through the German lines without them knowing it. We got onto the high ground. It was when we reached the high ground, at daylight the following morning, when we'd covered about 8 miles on foot. Not a shot was fired, not a knife was used. When the Germans started rousing for their reveille at 5:30, whatever time it may be, they discovered that there was half a brigade behind their lines, and a long way behind their lines. They started withdrawing their troops from their front line, and we were sandwiched between their rear troops and their forward troops. So we fought both ways. We fought in front of us and we fought behind us. And we caught the remnants of a marine division in that area, and we put paid to quite a lot of enemy troops, and they were good fighters too. We also destroyed 2 20mm flak guns that were being used at point blank range. You know, they weren't using as an anti-aircraft, they were literally hitting the trees in which we were located, or under which we were located, and using the shell bursts, air bursts, for the shrapnel to fall amongst us. But we soon got rid of them, and we were there for one day when the rest of the brigade came up, and we pushed on rapidly this time because we were catching the rear guard action of the German army. The fillet gap by this time was being closed, hadn't been completely closed. But when we got up to the River Seine at a place called Pont l'Evêque and Pont Audemer, and we in the brigade had to sweep right across to the seaside resort of Hornfleur. So once that area was, well, completely cleared, the role of the 1st Commando Brigade in Normandy was coming to a sad end, a sad and happy end.
Why sad?
We enjoyed our operations with 30 Corps under General Sir John Crocker, 8 Corps under somebody else, General Latterbury or whoever, 1 Corps. And we had a good association with the 6th Airborne Division, with whom we were operating all the time in Normandy. We got recalled back to England to regroup and, well, get our numbers together again, because we'd lost, of the original brigade, I think we lost for 50 to 60% of the original brigade. And we had to get back to regroup and re-equip. I mean, our rule was the assault rule, not to play the part of infantry soldiers or guardians of a concentration camp or a transit camp or a prisoner of war camp. We left Normandy on the 9th of September 1944. We got back to England, and then Number 4 Commando was divorced from the 1st Commando Brigade, and they joined the 4th Commando Brigade, and in their place came 46 Royal Marine Commandos. So the 1st Commando Brigade then comprised of 3 Commando Army, 6 Army Commando, 45 and 46 Royal Marine Commando. Now, because the war in Germany was still, against Germany was still going, we knew that either the 1st Commando Brigade would be replacing the 3rd Commando Brigade in Burma, because we'd already been trained in jungle warfare in September 43. So we thought we would be going to Burma. But when the three bridges at Nijmegen, Eindhoven, Nijmegen, and Arnhem took place, and the Arnhem one was not as successful as had been hoped, the 1st Commando Brigade was alerted to go back to Europe through from Tilbury to Antwerp. And Rundstedt, when he made his push at Christmas in 44, the 1st Commando Brigade was moved up to a place called Asten in Holland. And we were at Asten in support of 15th Scottish Division. And they were having trouble, they were having a little bit of difficulty, I believe, in crossing the Mars. And we did about 7 crossings of the Mars for various infantry and armoured divisions. We crossed the Mars for the 15th Scottish Division, got a bridgehead to cross there, got the 15th Scottish across. We came back again, went a little bit further up, a place called Maastricht. We crossed it again, and I think the 7th Armoured Division came over. We came back again. We went a little bit further down to Marzik. We crossed it again. And this time, I think the 11th Armoured went over. Then we came back. The Canadians were having a bit of problems.
Was this January 45?
Yeah. The Canadians were having a bit of problems in the Gok Cleeve Genep areas. That is between Wesel and Arnhem, between the Maas and the Rhine. So the 1st Commando Brigade, led by Derek Mills Roberts, we moved up to Gok in the Cleves area, and we were in the assist. Well, we went up to assist the 1st Canadian Army with assaults on small targets that they were having a little bit of problem with. And when Gok and Cleve and Genep were cleared, the Canadians had the entire stretch then, the Canadian Army had the entire stretch, and we moved down to a place called Gravinsel, which was immediately opposite the Wesel. Now, we got there about mid-March, and we had to wait there for storm boats to come, bridging equipment to come, because we, the 1st Commando Brigade, were going to cross the Rhine at Wesel, which we did on the night of the 23rd, 24th of March, 1945. Now, that was like another El Alamein in miniature. It was fantastic. The whole brigade were on one bank of the Rhine. There was very heavy, dense smoke screens right down the Rhine to deny the Germans observation of our movements, because by this time, a lot of bridging equipment and power boots, dories, storm boots, buffaloes, ducks, the amphibious vessels, were being brought up. Why I say it was like Alamein in miniature was because 250 Lancasters came over at around about 6 o'clock in the evening, and they were led by a Pathfinder. And they were flying at a height of about, I would say, no more than 1,000 feet. Now, you can imagine 250 Lancasters, 200,000 feet. As soon as the Pathfinder had got over the town of Wesel is a big town, was a big town, he dropped a chandelier of flares, and the remainder came over, and they dropped their bomb. They were huge. They were like big dustbins. They weren't 500-pounders, 1,000-pounders. They were these big boys. 5,000, 10,000 pounders. 200 Lancasters came over and they dropped all their bombs. When the last Lancaster flew past, the green flares came down, and that was a message for us to get across. Well, we got across. Now, how the Germans ever got their heads above the debris and the destruction of Wesel, don't ask me. This is why I say the key to the defences there, I think, lay in the fanaticism of the younger Nazis and German youth or whatever, where they just didn't give up. Because we were being fired on by machine gun fire, mortar fire and sniper fire all the time we were crossing the Rhine at Wesel. The road bridge had been blown, the railway bridge had been blown, and the only way across was by power dory, canoe, buffaloes, ducks, and weasels. There was another one of these little craft that were being used. Well, as soon as the entire brigade got across, we were told not to move any further, but to stay on the other bank. Now, we couldn't understand why, because here we were sitting ducks. We were in the wide open. We hadn't dug in or anything like that, because we were expecting to move into Wesel. So we naturally thought they were waiting for the dust to settle before we went in, you know, in case there was something in the bombs. We didn't know. It could have been chemicals. We wouldn't have known anyhow. Because when a bomb goes off, I mean, there's a tremendous smell of cordite, and it's an acrid smell. And we'd been used to